The Years of Lyndon Johnson, Means of Ascent by Robert A. Caro, continued, Cassette 11, Side 2. In addition, Clark ridicules the theory that Stevenson aides were also stealing votes on a widespread scale throughout the state. Asked about it, the secret boss of Texas laughs. "They didn't know how, and Governor Stevenson didn't know how," he says. And, Clark adds, in a view echoed by politicians familiar with Texas politics of the time, stealing votes on a widespread scale would have been impossible for Stevenson after Election Day, even had he wanted to try it. Preparations had to be made in advance for that sort of thing. Contacts have to be made. It takes organization. The Stevenson camp, Clark points out, was so unprepared for the second primary that they didn't even know that two of their counties weren't even holding a primary. But George Parr had done now for Lyndon Johnson what Shelton had feared could one day happen. The unwritten laws, the ethics, the morals of Texas politics were so loose and elastic that it was difficult to break them. But Lyndon Johnson had broken them. Stevenson was used to Valley politics. He had received the Valley's support in the past, not that its support had ever had any significance to his political career. But he knew the limits within which these politics operated, and he felt that it was by going beyond those limits that Lyndon Johnson had beaten him. The ex-governor felt particularly strongly about the timing of those decisive changes in the Valley's vote. Johnson had claimed that the votes in Duval, Jim Wells, Zapata, Starr, and other Parr-dominated counties had all been counted on election night, and that the counts had not been changed thereafter. Stevenson believed they had. He was certain that Johnson had, by those changes, stolen the election from him. Two things now motivated Coke Stevenson. One was personal, his injured vanity and pride, and the simple code by which he lived, the code of the West. When someone stole something from you, you got it back, or at least brought the thief to justice. The other went beyond the personal. It was his belief, the belief so deep it was almost like a religion to him, in democracy and the law. If this could happen, if an election could so blatantly be stolen, neither democracy nor law could prevail. He decided to do something about it. First, he sent men to the Valley. The head of the team investigating Duval County, San Antonio attorney Pete Tiarina, says that when they began interviewing residents who were certified as having voted, many said they hadn't. They told us their county commissioner had picked up their poll tax receipts and voted for them. But when the investigators tried to get these statements notarized, they found that no notary public in Duval County would do so. We were stopped by sheriff's deputies, one of whom had a submachine gun. They said they had heard we had guns. We told them we had no guns, but they made us spread eagle while they searched us. They then told us we had 30 minutes to get out of Duval County. We got out in that time. To investigate in Jim Wells County, Stevenson asked the help of three young attorneys. One, Callan Graham, had been an impoverished youth in Junction during the Depression. Stevenson had encouraged him to take up the law, had loaned him his books and his office to study in, and after Graham had been admitted to the bar in the old-fashioned way, without attending the university, had helped him through the early years of practice by quietly referring cases to him. Graham idolized Stevenson. He was proudest of his election in 1948 to the legislature because his seat was the one Coke had once held. The other two lawyers, Kellis DeBrell and James Gardner, partners in San Antonio, had been agents of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, in whose awesome reputation Stevenson believed. Stevenson telephoned them and, in DeBrell's words, asked them to go and see what we could find out. The three young attorneys were ill-equipped for the mission. "I had no badge or gun. I was a young lawyer," DeBrell recalls. "It was an awful big assignment, and I didn't know where to start." And they were, frankly, as Graham puts it, a little uptight going into this area we'd heard so much about. They had, he says, been warned at Stevenson's Austin headquarters that they were known to kill people down there. They said, "Be sure not to wear a suit coat so they can't see you don't have a gun." When the three young attorneys arrived in Alice at the end of that jouncing 150-mile trip through the empty South Texas brush country, the atmosphere in the little town did not relax them. Unshaven Mexican pistoleros, wearing Colts or carrying Winchester rifles, stood in groups along Main Street, silently staring at the visitors. The three young men had brought along a book on election law, but hardly had they arrived when they learned what so many visitors had learned before them. that Jim Wells County, like so much of the Texas brush country, was a land outside the law, in which printed legalities did not apply. The law stated clearly, Graham was to recall, that every citizen has a right to look at the election tally sheet and at the poll list, the list on which was recorded the names of individuals as they signed in to vote. It is very clearly stated in the law, so we thought there'd be no problem. These lists were in the possession of B.F. Tom Donald, secretary of Jim Wells County's Democratic Executive Committee and cashier at the Texas State Bank of Alice. That was George Parr's bank, but the three attorneys went to Donald's office at the bank and asked to see the lists. No, Donald replied, recalls Graham. We cited the law to him. That, in retrospect, was rather comical. We said, well, here's the law right here. It says any citizen has the right to see it. He said, I know that, but you can't see them because they're locked up in that vault, and I'm not going to unlock the vault. That's why you can't see them. As I say, that's kind of comical now. He didn't say he wasn't going to show them to us. He said, I won't open the vault. They're locked up in the bank vault, and I will not open it. Donald's refusal to show the lists made the three lawyers suspect that they might contain the proof they were looking for, the proof that the Precinct 13 vote had been altered, that the crucial 200 votes had been added to Lyndon Johnson's total after the polls had closed, and after the time on election night when the smaller total had been reported to the Texas Election Bureau. The lawyers went to see the reform members of the county's Democratic Executive Committee, who confirmed these suspicions. One reform member, B.M. Brownlee, said that he had seen the precinct's tally list, from which the Executive Committee had been taking the vote prior to making its official report. And as Brownlee was later to testify, about possibly 200 tallies from the end, the ink in which the votes were being marked had changed. The tallies up to that point had been written almost entirely in black ink. After that point, they were all in blue ink. Harry Lee Adams, who had snuck in as new chairman of the Executive Committee while Parr wasn't looking, had first been denied a look at the lists by Donald, although by law he, not Donald, was the official entitled to their possession. But on a later visit to the bank, he had, although still denied possession of the lists, been allowed a brief look at the poll list. And his brief look, Adams said, had been enough. While he was jotting down the names of the individuals who had allegedly voted, he said, he had noticed that approximately 200 names from the end, at number 842, to be precise, the ink in which they were written had changed. Prior to number 842, the names had all been written in black ink. Beginning with 842, they had all been written in blue ink. Brownlee and Adams's stories convinced the three lawyers that the poll and tally lists contained the proof of the dishonesty of the voting in Precinct 13. With the lists, they felt, they could get the names of all the final 200 voters and simply ask them if they had indeed voted in the election and whom they had voted for. And the voters' testimony could be presented in a court of law. But Donald had refused to show them the lists, and they were not anxious to make another trip to the bank. They were, they admit, intimidated by the thought of walking again down that dusty street with men glaring at them and fingering rifles and revolvers as they passed. So Coke Stevenson went to the valley himself, and he took along with him a representative of another law enforcement body, one in which he, as a Texan, had even more faith than he had in the FBI, and one which was, in Texas, even more revered, the Texas Rangers. And he didn't take along just any ranger, but one of the toughest rangers of them all, a ranger who was, in fact, a figure even more legendary in Texas than Stevenson himself. For just before he left Austin, he met Frank Hamer on the street. 30 years earlier, when Frank Hamer was a young ranger and Coke Stevenson a young county attorney newly appointed to his first public office, the two men had lain out together night after night in the hills of Kimball County to catch cattle rustlers. During the intervening years, they had become hunting companions and close friends. And now, when Hamer heard that Stevenson was going to the valley, and heard why he was going, he stared at him for a long minute. And then he said, "Well, I'll just go down there with you." It was Frank Hamer who led the posse of lawmen who trailed Bonnie and Clyde for 102 days and set the ambush in which the famous bank robbers were finally killed. But that was only one of the episodes that had garlanded his career with glory. He first pinned on a Rangers star in 1906, when he was 22 years old, 6'3", 200 pounds, with broad shoulders and a lightning draw. His initial assignment was as one of the 17 Rangers dispatched to curb the riots, punctuated by murders, which had been raging through the Rio Grande Valley for months despite the efforts of hundreds of federal troops. The success of the 17 led to the remark, possibly apocryphal, that came to symbolize the Texas Rangers. The sheriff of a mob-ravaged city telegraphed Ranger headquarters for assistance and received word it would arrive on the next train. When the train pulled in, the sheriff was dismayed to see only one man disembark. "Only one ranger?" he asked. "Only one mob," the ranger explained. Hamer then became a town tamer, in a town, Navasota, that was very tough to tame. When he pinned on the city marshal's badge there, Navasota was a boom town in which shootouts on the main street were so frequent that in 2 years at least 100 men had died. After 2 years of what a writer called Hamer's stern and unremitting justice, shootouts were a thing of the past. Nobody wanted to incur Frank Hamer's wrath. Asked if he knew the marshal, a man replied, "Yes, sir, and when I sees him coming, I just steps aside." Not long thereafter, he was the state's key witness in a trial being held in a West Texas town. In an attempt to prevent him from testifying, a gunman jumped out from a hiding place and shot him at point-blank range as he was passing on the street. Wounded in his gun arm and hand, but still on his feet, Hamer, as one writer put it, calmly observed that the man's gun had jammed. He snatched it out of his assailant's hand. A second gunman jumped out and fired. Barely missing Hamer's head, the bullet tore a hole in his Stetson. Seeing him still on his feet, the two assailants turned and ran. One kept running. He was to escape until he was later arrested. The other made the mistake of pausing for a last shot. By this time, Hamer, despite his wound, had his gun out in his uninjured hand and shot him dead. By the 1930s, Frank Hamer had been wounded 17 times. At least twice he had been left for dead. He had killed 53 men. Despite his refusal to give interviews and his dislike of publicity, the tall, powerful Texas Ranger, with his black suit, his invariable courtesy, and his laconic speech, had become a mythical figure in Texas. Historian Walter Prescott Webb called him one of the most fearless men in Western history. A Hollywood writer said, "It's embarrassing to describe Frank Hamer in these days of Westerns. One can hear about him, and then one realizes that Hamer is the real character all casting directors are striving for." His toughness had become mythical, too. Looking down at Bonnie's bullet-riddled body in 1934, he had affected regret at having been forced to shoot a woman. But asked in private about the climactic gun battle, he would say, "I sure did hate to bust a cap on a lady," and smile. And his reputation and his grim bearing were weapons in themselves. During the 30s, when he was more than 50 years old, he was called in to end the violence in a particularly bloody dock strike in Houston. Walking out onto a dock on which swirled an angry crowd of striking longshoremen, Hamer approached the largest man he could find. "I'm Frank Hamer," the big ranger said. "This strike is over." And it was. In 1948, he was 64 years old and long retired from regular duty. Although as a special ranger employed by the Texas Oil Company to protect its property, he was still allowed to carry a gun. He didn't wear it anymore, but when Coke Stevenson told him he was going to the valley, he went home and strapped it on before they set out. Arriving in Alice, they met Debrell and Gardner in a room in the Alice Hotel and were told that the election records were still being kept in the bank. Stevenson said he wanted to go there, and the two lawyers said that, of course, they would go, too. While they were up in the room, the whisper was running through the town, "Coke Stevenson's here, and Frank Hamer's with him." A reporter walking into the courthouse heard the name on all sides, "Hamer, Hamer." Hamer told the men in the hotel room to take off their suit jackets so that people could see they weren't armed. He took his off, too, so that people could see he was. They clattered down the stairs of the rickety little hotel and out onto the dusty main street, and, in a scene that would be incredible were it not attested to by witnesses for both sides, walked the 200 yards to the bank. The lawyers trailed a few paces behind. Coke Stevenson and Frank Hamer walked side by side, two tall, broad-shouldered, erect, silent men, two living legends of Texas, in fact, two men out of another vanishing age, another vanishing code, marching down a street in a dusty Texas town to find out for themselves and prove to the world how Lyndon Johnson had gotten the 200 crucial votes. Back in the hotel room, the two young lawyers had been a little disappointed at their first look at the legendary Frank Hamer. He appeared to be an old man, Debrell recalls. And then, coming out of the hotel, Hamer saw George Parr's pistoleros. There were more of them this time. Everywhere you turned, there were people with guns on, Debrell says. One group of perhaps five was directly in Hamer's path. Another, somewhat larger, was standing in the very door of the bank. As he approached them, Hamer didn't even slow down. His biographers were to write that when he approached the first group, he said, "Git," and at the second he ordered, "Fall back." The two young attorneys don't remember any words at all. They only remember how, walking behind the old Texas Ranger, they suddenly realized how big he was and how he carried himself, and how his right hand was poised just above the butt of his gun, his fingers curled for the draw. And they remember how, as Debrell puts it, when Frank Hamer walked down the street, those clusters of people parted. The pistoleros in front of the bank, having stepped aside for Stevenson, evidently intended to follow the ex-governor inside, but Hamer turned and stood in the doorway, his hand still poised above his gun. None of the men facing him moved. After a few minutes, they walked away. Inside, Stevenson was confronting Tom Donald in his office. He said he wanted to see the tally sheet and the poll list and copy all the names on the poll list, and when Donald refused to allow him to do so, Stevenson, as he was to state in an affidavit, advised him that I was being deprived of my rights under federal law, and advised him also, in the dry words of the affidavit, of the consequence thereof. Recalls the one reporter who was present, James M. Rowe of the Corpus Christi Caller Times, "Coke was like a glacier. He could look really mean." Donald took the list and tally sheet from his desk and showed them to Stevenson and his men, and for a few moments, a vital few moments, Debrell and Gardner studied them intently. When they began copying names from the list, Donald said, "No, you can't do that," and snatched it away. But the two lawyers had had time to memorize some of the names and the numbers beside them, and they rushed out into the bank's outer room and wrote them down. They had been alerted by Adams and Brownlee as to the crucial points, and they had looked at those first, and they had had time to confirm what the two local men had told them, that the last 201 names on the list, 200 of whom were listed as voting for Johnson, one for Stevenson, had been written in the same ink, different from that previously used, and in the same handwriting, different from that which had previously appeared. They noticed, moreover, something that the two Alice men had not, that the 201 names were in alphabetical order. The first few names, starting with 842, began with A, the next few with B, until about 915, when the end of the alphabet was reached. Then the A's began again, as if whoever had been writing the names had miscalculated and gotten to the end of the alphabet too fast, and had thereupon simply gone back to the A's and started over. The two lawyers also did something that Adams and Brownlee had not done. They had memorized, and now wrote down, the last name in black ink, the name of voter 841. If the moment of change came at 8:42, who was 8:41, and what could he tell them? James Gardner had also looked at the tally sheet, and had made a discovery that dwarfed all the others. Johnson's partisans were arguing that the count of Precinct 13 had not been changed, that no one had ever said Johnson's vote total was 765, that it had always been 965. The certification on the tally sheet gave the lie to that argument, Gardner felt. The certification showed that the vote for Lyndon Johnson was 965, he was to testify, but it was evident from looking at the 965 that the 9 had been changed. It previously had been a 7. The 7 had been worked over in pen and ink from a 7 around to a 9. An additional loop had been added to the 7 to make a 9 out of it. Armed with the names they had jotted down and those that Adams had obtained earlier, Debrell and Gardner, together with Graham, set out to ascertain if these voters could furnish additional information about the balloting in Precinct 13. It turned out that they could furnish quite a bit. Persuading them to give evidence was difficult because of the atmosphere of fear. Fear of Parr, of Louis Salas and his deputies, of Parr's lawyer Ed Lloyd, and for the unsophisticated, all but uneducated members of Alice's Mexican-American community, of Anglos in general. One of Stevenson's attorneys was to remember vividly years later how one Mexican man told him, "People live longer down here if they keep their mouths shut." Nevertheless, evidence was given. The 841st voter on the poll list, the voter who, Stevenson's allies were convinced, was the last person who had in fact voted, was Eugenio Solis, a 28-year-old worker on a county highway crew. And Solis told them that he felt he probably had indeed been the last voter. He had arrived at the Nayer School voting place at about 6:40 p.m. on election day, 20 minutes before the polls closed. When he left some minutes later after voting, there was no one else there voting besides me, and there was no one else coming up to vote. Would Solis give an affidavit affirming his statement? Gardner asked him. Solis said he would, and he did so, sitting in Gardner's automobile, while Gardner, resting a portable typewriter on his lap, took his statement down, and the notary listened and attested to it. Although Solis said he understood it in English, his statement was read to him in Spanish by Conrado Martinez, a local businessman, and Solis signed it. Then Stevenson's lawyers turned to the 201 names listed after Solis on the poll list of voters, 200 of whom, the tally sheet said, had voted for Lyndon Johnson. Brownlee had taken 9 of these names down during his brief look at the poll list, and the young lawyers had jotted down additional names. They asked each of these people if they had voted for Lyndon Johnson. No, they replied, they had not. They had not, they said, voted for anyone. Without exception, the voters questioned said they had not been to the polls at all on election day. For one of these persons, 21-year-old Hector Cerda, a college student, voting in Jim Wells County would have been difficult. He hadn't been in Jim Wells County that day, he explained. He had spent the day in the town of Farr, 109 miles away, and had not returned until late that night, long after the polls had closed. For 3 other persons whose names were listed as voting, voting would have been even more difficult. They had been dead for some years. Now, Coke Stevenson believed, he had proof that the decisive 200 votes had been stolen, that they had not been cast by voters at all, that that number had simply been added to Lyndon Johnson's total several days after the election. And he believed that this proof would enable him to have these votes thrown out and give him victory. They could be thrown out at either of 2 levels, local or state, and he moved on both levels at once. While what one newspaper described as a small army of attorneys went from house to house in Alice collecting affidavits, Stevenson swore to his own, summarizing the evidence of fraud, errors, and irregularities in Precinct 13 already collected, filed it with the county clerk, and petitioned the Jim Wells County Democratic Executive Committee to meet and recertify a new, correct tabulation of the county's votes to the state Democratic Executive Committee. 10 of the 17 members of the newly elected county committee met. They heard their new chairman, Harry Adams, their secretary, Ike Poole, and B.M. Brownlee add to Stevenson's affidavit what they themselves knew about the counting of the vote at the Nayer School and about their own investigation. As a result, Poole was to say, "I am confident there are more than 200 people shown as voting who did not vote." Poole was also to tell reporters, "I helped gather the evidence and obtain affidavits for more than 200 such people." The committee then passed a resolution which its members felt would eliminate the 200 votes once and for all. It was certainly unequivocal enough. The Democratic Committee of Jim Wells County has evidence of fraud and irregularities in the county's Precinct 13, it said, and it is the opinion of the committee that the certified report to the state committee was not a true and correct picture of the results of the election as held in that precinct. Since the committee had been denied all records of the voting in Precinct 13, it could not determine the true vote, the resolution said, and it therefore could not draw up a new certification to replace the one already sent to the state committee. The state committee should therefore itself determine the correct vote and substitute it for the incorrect one. Later that day, the reformers on the committee, meeting among themselves, decided that the denial of the records need not handcuff them as totally as that resolution implied, and that they could draw up a new certification themselves without waiting for the state committee. The certification could either return the Precinct 13 vote to the one originally reported election night, thereby removing 200 votes from Johnson's total, or, since the fraud and irregularities in that precinct were, they felt, so widespread, they could throw out the precinct entirely, thereby removing 965 votes from Johnson's total and 61 from Stevenson's. It is expected, the Austin American Statesman reported, that an entirely new resolution of certification will be drawn up by the new county committee and presented to the Democratic State Executive Committee as a substitute for that filed by the outgoing committee. And the committee members said since they were legally entitled to those voting lists, why not move legally to force Donald to turn them over? There were lawyers in Alice who were not under Parr's domination. They would hire one to force the bank cashier to do so. Stevenson's other recourse was his party. Its nominees would be determined at the party's convention in Fort Worth that was to begin the following Monday, September 13th, after reports from a canvassing subcommittee and from the full 62-member state executive committee. Customarily, the committee certifications were pro forma. As a result of court decisions, it was generally accepted that neither committee would seriously consider disallowing an individual county's certification. But there was nothing pro forma about this election, and the executive committee members were sufficiently sophisticated about politics to understand what had happened down there in Precinct 13 and in the Valley as a whole, and the implications for future close statewide elections. What had happened, others felt, was simply too raw, too blatant. Moreover, many of the committee's members were old friends of Koch's. In Fort Worth, Stevenson issued a statement saying he was prepared to appear before the executive committee with proof that the returns in Jim Wells are not correct. They knew Koch. If he said he had proof, he had proof. When the committee members arrived in Fort Worth that weekend, reporters quickly realized that the Jim Wells certification was not considered a typical example of Texas election chicanery, but an exceptional case, and was going to be seriously considered. "Senate race more doubtful," the headlines suddenly said. "Spotlight turns on South Texas." On, to be more specific, a tiny town in South Texas. As the Corpus Christi Caller Times explained in a lead paragraph beginning with a rather unfamiliar dateline, "Alice, voting precinct 13 at Alice, not Duval or Harris or Dallas counties, and its 1,027 disputed votes Friday became the issue that may decide whether Lyndon B. Johnson or Koch R. Stevenson will be the next senator from Texas." Reporters raced to the valley. On primary day, James M. Rowe of the Caller Times had been unable to interest any major newspaper or wire service in the reports from Jim Wells County. Now, he recalls, "all of a sudden people seemed to realize that a little town in Texas had elected a United States senator." Under the headline, "The Duke Delivers," Time magazine said, "Last week many Democrats from North and West Texas, who never considered the dapper Duke of Duval anything more than a local political princeling, found he had become a powerful kingmaker." In the stretch of one of the closest political races in U.S. history, he was the man most responsible for Congressman Lyndon Johnson's nomination over Koch Stevenson for the U.S. Senate. Texas newspapers were agog over the biggest political story in the state's history, and Texas reporters began to zero in on the specific charge Stevenson was making. A reporter from the Houston Chronicle interviewed Ike Poole, and the headline over the interview said flatly, "200 votes given Johnson after primary." For months, the political headlines had drummed the words Taft-Hartley into public consciousness. Now, suddenly and repeatedly, there was in the headlines a new word, fraud. Politics, the new politics, helped Johnson counter Stevenson's efforts. The influence of national politics and power in a state, already so evident during the campaign itself, was to intensify during the party's convention. The 1948 Texas convention had national political implications. In four southern states, Democrats had broken away from the national ticket and formed the States' Rights Party, which would, in November, carry these states for its presidential candidate, J. Strom Thurmond. For Harry Truman, far behind Thomas Dewey in the polls, it was considered imperative to keep Texas from deserting his party. The delegates chosen in May who didn't support him had to be ousted at this convention. The fight to do so would hinge on the ability of the Loyalist, in general liberal Truman Democrats, to unseat the legally elected, by in some cases overwhelming margins, delegations from the big counties, Harris, Dallas, and Tarrant, on the convention floor, a fight which was going to be very close. Johnson made use of this fact. The liberals, more sophisticated than the run of Texas politicians, were aware of Johnson's true less-than-liberal record in Washington. Although he was more liberal than Stevenson, their support of him had never been enthusiastic. More idealistic on the whole than other Texas politicians, many of them were as outraged as the conservatives over the manner in which Johnson had attained his 87-vote majority. But now feelings about the senatorial campaign were submerged in feelings about the presidential race, and Johnson told his men to take advantage of those feelings. They made an offer to the Loyalist leaders. The delegates with whom he would have influence at the convention most notably the delegations from Austin, San Antonio, and the Valley, would vote to unseat the states' rights delegations and vote to seat Loyalist delegations in their place. They would also vote for the Loyalist candidates for the new state executive committee, which would be elected at the end of the convention, and for Loyalist candidates to all other convention posts. In return, Johnson asked for only one thing. It was couched in legal terms. His men, headed by Wirtz, Connally was doing much of the legwork, were ostensibly asking for certification of the senatorial vote as it had been sent in by the individual counties, with no changes, and they claimed that this was the course prescribed by law. But what they were really asking for was plain to the Loyalist leaders. Says one of them, Robert Eckert, later a Houston congressman and in 1948 a key figure in the Loyalist group, Johnson was interested in preventing Box 13 from being opened. His major purpose was not to permit the opening of Box 13. The request made them all the more aware of what the crucial box was likely to contain, and ordinarily they might have balked. But now, as Eckert puts it, it seemed much more important to a lot of us that there not be a bunch of presidential electors that could throw away Texas votes instead of giving them to Truman. So, in his words, Connally and I connived on that, and the deal was struck. Publicity helped, too. Johnson countered Stevenson's charges of vote-stealing by saying, over statewide radio networks, that actually it had been Stevenson who had stolen votes, not he. Stevenson's supporters were strangely silent about the block vote which gave my opponent a 30,000-vote lead coming out of three big cities, Johnson said. Moreover, Johnson said, in Dallas, they have counted me out of 2,000 votes. And nobody has asked for an investigation of the River Oaks box of Houston, where Stevenson got 8 out of every 10 votes cast. In Brown County, he said, there was vote switching. He had been cheated in rural counties as well. You didn't hear of the Kennedy County block vote, where only 8 votes were in the Johnson column, he said, and listed 3 other suspicious counties or boxes. These charges would not have been very convincing to anyone who examined them closely. In Dallas, for example, there had been 5 changes in the returns, and not all of them favored Stevenson. Besides, they were the result not of late returns, but of clerical errors, made by a clerk who typed a 9 instead of a 7 in a Johnson column. The most significant of them gave Johnson, not Stevenson, 2,000 more votes than he deserved. Dallas's official certificate, as one writer pointed out, corrected that error, and the final returns were certified without protest from Johnson leaders on September 4th. Johnson's reference to Stevenson's 30,000 total plurality in Houston, Dallas, and Fort Worth as a block vote is totally misleading. In none of the 3 cities, which together cast a total of 173,627 votes, 100,479 for Stevenson and 73,148 for Johnson, was there any pattern of block voting other than the normal heavy majorities for Stevenson in upper-income, conservative precincts, and for Johnson in low-income black and Mexican precincts, and in precincts with heavy concentrations of workers in defense-related industries. Houston's River Oaks box, where Stevenson got 8 out of every 10 votes, was the city's wealthiest enclave. It always voted heavily for a conservative candidate. Nobody but Johnson ever suggested that there was any illegality in the voting there. In saying that nobody has asked for an investigation of it, Johnson was correct, and nobody ever would. In Brown County, there certainly was a heated contest going on. However, it was not over the Senate election, but over the election of a county judge. Ballots would indeed be ruled invalid there, but not because of anything to do with the Senate race. As for rural counties, in Kennedy County, which Johnson charged was a block vote, he was correct, but the block was only 52 votes. Kennedy County consisted almost entirely of a division of the King Ranch, whose owners, the Claybergs, distrusted Johnson. In the other 2 rural counties he mentioned, the totals were also minuscule. Not one of the state's 254 counties voted for Stevenson by ratios comparable to those Johnson received in the Valley. Votes were certainly stolen for Stevenson. Stevenson's totals were corrected in dozens of counties, just as Johnson's were corrected in dozens of counties other than the Valley counties, but in numbers so small as to bear no comparison to the majorities Johnson received in the Valley. Furthermore, the corrections in the totals of the 2 candidates after Election Day, corrections which followed the traditional Texas pattern, were so balanced as to virtually offset each other. These corrections had no significance in the final result. Having seen the evidence and filed his affidavit, Stevenson left Alice with Frank Hamer on Friday evening, September 10th. Before him was the weekend, during which the reform majority of the Jim Wells County Democratic Committee was determined to meet and correct the county's voting tally before the state Democratic Convention began. At the far side of the weekend at 10 a.m. Monday, the convention would open in Fort Worth to certify the result of the primary. All through that weekend, Coke Stevenson and Lyndon Johnson engaged in a grim, bitter struggle, and during it a pattern emerged that was to characterize the remainder of the fight between the two men. Stevenson was trying to get the ballot box and record of Precinct 13 open to let Texans see the evidence that he and his men had seen, the loop added to change a 7 into a 9, and the 200 ballots that supposedly supported that change. Johnson was trying to keep the records closed. The pattern was set in the weekend's opening skirmish. The meeting of the Jim Wells Democratic Committee, at which reformers were planning formally to demand the records, and whether or not they were produced to throw out the tainted 200 votes, might be convened at any moment. It had to be stopped, and it had to be stopped fast. Behind the broad, amiable smile of Alvin Wirtz was the mind as quick as chain lightning, the mind that was always thinking 3 steps ahead of his opponents. On Saturday morning, while the Jim Wells reformers were planning their strategy for the county committee meeting, telegrams were delivered to each of their homes. Telegrams signed by a judge forbidding them to hold one. Jim Wells County was in the state's 79th judicial district. The district court was, Dudley Lynch writes, George Parr's home turf. The judge, Lawrence Broter of Alice, his loyal supporter. But on this crucial Friday, Judge Broter happened to be holding court in Starr County. It would take perhaps 2 hours to get there and locate him, and in 2 hours a meeting might be convened, a new certification made. There were, however, judges conveniently to hand in Austin. An affidavit was hastily typed up, and Lyndon Johnson signed it. In it, Johnson charged that Stevenson, Hamer, and DeBrell, as well as Adams, Poole, and the other 15 members of the Jim Wells Committee, had entered into a conspiracy for the purpose of causing the votes in Precinct Number 13 in Jim Wells County to be thrown out on the grounds of fraud and irregularity. Johnson claimed that Stevenson had threatened and intimidated Adams and Poole into calling a meeting of the committee to make a new tabulation, and that Adams would call that meeting at any instant unless restrained. And Johnson therefore asked that a temporary restraining order be issued on the spot, without a hearing, to stop the committee from making any new tabulation or attempting to re-canvass the votes in Precinct Number 13, or hearing any contest, or eliminating any votes on grounds of illegality, fraud, and from making, sending, or filing with the State Democratic Executive Committee any returns, other than those already sent in, the ones containing the disputed 200 votes, until Broter could rule. Everett Looney hurried over to an Austin District Judge, Roy Archer, of the 126th District, with the affidavit and a proposed injunction signed by him and Wirtz. Looney's name came first. Wirtz never put his name first on anything if he could help it, and the argument that unless the order was issued at once, Johnson would suffer irreparable harm from the committee's conspiracy. Archer signed the order, and telegrams embodying it were instantly dispatched to every committee member. Archer's order shocked attorneys knowledgeable in the state's election law. One historian was to state that the order amazed and angered others not directly related to the proceedings or to the Senate race. Lawyers across the state searched in vain for a legal precedent for an Austin judge restraining an official Democratic Party meeting hundreds of miles away in another county. Stevenson understood the reason for Wirtz's maneuver. It was, he said angrily, an obvious attempt to prevent the truth from coming out of Jim Wells County until after the state executive committee has canvassed the returns on Monday. But the judicial order was a judicial order. When Adams, who of course did not feel he had been intimidated or threatened by anyone, at least not by anyone on Coke Stevenson's side, took Archer's telegram to an anti-Parr attorney in Alice, he was told bluntly what it meant. Even if it, the election, was stolen, you're not to do anything. Wirtz's maneuver worked. Of course we'll obey the law, Poole told a reporter. There would be no meeting until Judge Broter ruled. And Broter, George Parr's loyal supporter, notified of Archer's order, said he would hold the hearing, but not until Monday morning. Monday, of course, was the day of the state committee canvassing. And once the state committee had opened the Jim Wells returns, the returns which the present Jim Wells committee felt were false, and certified them, the feelings of the Jim Wells committee wouldn't matter. While his lawyers were fighting the rearguard delaying action in Alice over the weekend, Lyndon Johnson himself was engaged on the main front in Fort Worth, 500 miles to the north. He had rushed there on Sunday afternoon after dispatches from his lieutenants told him that on this front he was losing. Two battles, two votes, would be waged on this front on Monday. The first vote would be taken by a 7-member subcommittee of the State Executive Committee, the party's ruling body, to canvass and certify, in theory to examine and make official, the returns from the 252 counties that had held elections, and then to make a report, in effect a recommendation as to who the party's nominee should be, to the full 62-member executive committee. The second vote would be taken by the executive committee on whether or not to accept the canvassing subcommittee's report, on whether, in other words, to recommend that the full convention name as the party's official nominee the candidate named by the subcommittee, or some other candidate. In this election, the canvassing subcommittee's certifications of the votes from the individual counties would be more than usually crucial. Once it had made official the vote from Jim Wells County to the executive committee, the attempts of the reformers down in Alice to submit a revised return would be largely moot. The certified return, the original return, would now be in the hands of the executive committee, with the weight of the subcommittee's certification behind it. If, however, the subcommittee refused to certify the Jim Wells vote, the nature of the entire Johnson-Stevenson fight could change dramatically and unpredictably. The range of possibilities seemed endless. But one clear possibility loomed as disastrous to Johnson's supporters, that the reformers in Alice would, before the subcommittee finished its work, submit a revised return, one with the 200 disputed Johnson votes subtracted from the county total, and that the subcommittee would certify that return instead of the original, thereby giving Stevenson a higher total statewide vote than Johnson. It was to forestall this possibility that Alvin Wirtz had obtained that temporary injunction forbidding the Jim Wells County Committee to revise the county's return. Without a revised return before it, the canvassing subcommittee could not, of course, certify it to the full executive committee. There would be nothing for it to certify except the original. On Monday, Johnson would be safe from a revised return as long as Judge Archer's injunction remained in force. That holding action in that district court down in Alice was therefore the key to the subcommittee battle in Fort Worth. His attorneys felt Judge Broder might well keep the injunction in force until some later date. But even if Broder dissolved the injunction, Johnson would still be safe so long as the dissolution did not come too early in the day. As far as the subcommittee battle was concerned, delay was the key. All that was required for victory was a delay of a few hours. Since the court hearing and the subcommittee's county-by-county certifications would be going forward simultaneously on Monday morning, there would be 10 hours until Johnson could be sure that his attorneys back in Alice had delayed long enough. His attorneys assured him they would be able to do so. The projections for Monday's second battle, the vote that evening in the party's 62-member executive committee, were, however, far less optimistic. The executive committee vote would be the decisive vote at the convention. By custom, as Alan Duckworth wrote, the full 2,000-member convention accepts without question the report of an executive committee on winners of primary nominations. Johnson's advisers felt that it was the executive committee vote that would decide the outcome of his long fight. And polling the committee's 62 members, his advisers found to their consternation that a majority favored rejecting any report from the canvassing subcommittee that did not throw out the tainted Jim Wells votes and name as the Democratic nominee not Lyndon Johnson but Coke Stevenson. Clark and Connolly, bitter enemies who agreed on little, agree on the situation in Fort Worth that weekend in the same three words. We were behind. No parade greeted Lyndon Johnson when he got off the plane in Fort Worth this time. He was met by worried faces and big black headlines. Showdown Monday. This book is continued on Cassette 12, Side 1.